Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Rachel Smolker. She's a co-director of Biofuel Watch and an organizer with Energy Justice Network. She's researched, written, and organized on the impacts of biofuels, bioenergy, and biochar on land use, forests, biodiversity, food, people, and the climate. She has a PhD in ecology/biology. She's author of To Touch a Wild Dolphin and lives in Vermont. So first, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give people a quick introduction to biofuels, bioenergy, biochar? What are they, and why do you care about working on them?
Okay, sure. Well, a lot of people are really familiar already with the corn ethanol, which is currently using about 40% of the U.S. corn crop. And we burn it in our cars whether we want to or not, for the most part, because it's mandated that we mix it with our fuels. And most people are also somewhat familiar with biodiesel, which is generally made from soybeans or palm oil or sometimes used cooking oil, which there's not a huge amount of out there. But those two, I think a lot of people are pretty familiar with. At least they know that they exist and have seen it, and many people have even heard or read about some of the more negative impacts of that on land use and so on.
But wait, aren't they really great and eco-groovy? Because I know some like really eco-groovy people who've got biodiesel cars. Isn't that a great thing?
Well, in a nutshell, it can be okay, but only on a very, very small scale. And what we have right now is, you know, in the United States and also in other countries and at various levels, we have mandates that require us to mix biofuels with our petrol, and to a certain level. And there's a ton of, you know, taxpayer-funded subsidies that are going into making that happen. And the impacts, well, for example, with corn ethanol, it's had a domino effect through the entire corn commodity price network internationally. So prices of corn and prices of food have gone up as a result of basically redirecting so much of the American corn crop into ethanol, which has caused a price rise and a lot of instability in the prices, and people in Mexico and people elsewhere who are feeling the impact of that on their food prices and not happy about it, understandably. So in 2008 or so, when the food crisis really hit and the food, a lot of skyrocketing price of food, a big player in what was going on there was the starting to really feel the effect of putting so much of our corn and also soybeans into biofuels. So at that big scale, no, it's not a great thing. There are certainly people who make biodiesel from used cooking oil in their neighborhoods and run their cars on that, which, you know, is probably less bad, let's say, than these very large scale, federally mandated, subsidized versions of biofuels. So, but I wanted to get back to the question, which is, you know, we're kind of familiar, I think, with corn ethanol and with biodiesel, but what a lot of people, I think, don't realize, first of all, is that what I believe you've spoken about before, had another interview scheduled, which is burning wood for electricity, which is a practice that is coming more and more into practice and has huge impacts for climate and so on, and for forests and biodiversity. But there's more to it. The bottom line is that we can make almost anything that we can make from fossil fuels from living biomass. Fossil fuels are derived from living biomass that has gone through a process of fossilization. So the chemistry has a lot of similarities, and we can make many of the things that we currently make from fossil fuels from living plant material. The problem, of course, is that we have a tiny, precious, thin little cover of plant material. I like to prefer to call it biomass. I mean, I prefer not to call it biomass, but rather to call it biodiversity. We have a thin little net of that around the surface of this planet. And the demand for meeting all of the needs that we currently fill from fossil fuels, to try and meet those from that thin little precious coating of biodiversity that we have on this planet is basically nuts and has already had very serious consequences, you know, not just for people and for food prices, but also for biodiversity, land use, water, nutrients, soil depletion, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. So no, it's not a good thing. And it goes way beyond biofuels. It goes into making plastics, biochemicals. The military is very interested now in biofueling their activities, by the way, which is a little bit worrying. But you can buy carpet made from corn. You can buy cloth and diapers and, you know, all of the things that we are accustomed to making from petroleum can be made from living plant biomass. And it's very, very dependent also on the biotechnology industry, which is busily working to engineer crops that are more easily converted into those materials, or to engineer microbes using synthetic biology in particular, which is sort of a new, some people refer to as genetic engineering on steroids. Very risky and unregulated new technologies for manipulating genes. And the point of their interest, of their research, is to try to create microbes that are going to either pump out chemicals and fuels directly using plant biomass, or be able to break down plant biomass in order to produce all these chemicals and fuels and other things. So there's a lot of focus on engineering of microbes and creating new kinds of enzymes. So it's a big push from a huge, let's say, convergence of interest between the fossil fuel companies and all the interests in preserving the infrastructure of business as usual, if you will, with big agribusiness, big forestry, and biotechnology industries.
And I mean, you know, when I made the comment earlier that I was being, that was kind of an ironic question, and that it, I mean, it's also a convergence in some ways of some of the big greens, because that's why I sort of said the thing about eco groovy is that, you know, I've gotten so many people over the years who've written to me to say, you know, Derek, I don't really like your analysis about how this culture is killing the planet, because biochar will save us all. Or, you know, it's, my point simply was that it's, there's also this convergence also of sort of some of the new environmentalism that isn't really about protecting places, but about trying to sustain this way of life. And there's that convergence too, it seems.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's a lot of people who are grasping at straws, and biochar is definitely one of them. I'm always sort of mystified and sort of entertained at the same time by the hype around biochar, because, you know, basically it's charcoal, and you have to burn things like wood from trees to make it. I mean, if you're just doing it in your backyard for your own interest in your garden, that's one thing. But, you know, the International Biochar Initiative and many enthusiasts of biochar have been promoting it as a means of offsetting emissions from fossil fuels. The tar sands industry has been interested in using biochar as a basically an excuse for their ongoing pollution. And many of the people who are so enthusiastic about biochar just haven't really looked at the whole full equation of costs and of it, and also at the science. People can find on our website, we reviewed some years ago, we did a review looking only at the impacts of studies that were done in the field, because of course you can take some sterile soil that's, you know, got nothing living in it and do something, you know, add biochar to it and then look at how plants grow. And that's just not a real reflection of the real world, because soils are living and are loaded with living microorganisms. So looking at the impacts of biochar, you have to look at living soils in the field. And actually, you know, whereas the biochar enthusiasts will talk about, oh, it's guaranteed to sequester carbon for thousands of years, just like it did in the Amazon where these indigenous people did it. The studies that have been done have been, you know, a few years at best, and many of them have shown actually less carbon after biochar has been addition, because something happens called priming, where the living biota in the soil is just actually digests some of the carbon that was already there before the biochar was added. So, and then they also claim great improvements in crop yields, which also have been very, very mixed results. Sometimes crops do worse after biochar additions. So there's a lot of hype around it, and the science does not support it, and it certainly should not be put up there as some kind of salvation, because on a scale that would have any impact on climate or otherwise, you would have to use major parts of the planet. In fact, char lots of the remaining forests on the earth.
So can you define biochar for listeners?
Yes. Well, it's often spoken about as being a product of pyrolysis, which is just burning with a limited oxygen. But the reality is that there's no real commercial pyrolysis production of biochar at this point. There's one company, Cool Planet, that I invite people to go and just check them out. The vast majority of what's being, called biochar is essentially identical to charcoal. So it's the charred remains of plant material, which is, got a lot of carbon retained into it. Charcoal is basically carbon. And the idea, of course, is that you have this carbon, which is part of the content of the initial, say, tree that you burned, and you bury it under the soil, and the carbon is stored in the soil and away from the atmosphere. In theory, that's the idea.
So, see, that's what I really wanted to hear, because I've never understood how anybody who cares about the world could think that it's a good idea to take a living tree who is then also home to all the insects and birds and microorganisms and newts who live in and around this tree, and cut it down and bury it. That just seems like, I remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, one of the schemes put forward by the timber industry was that they should cut down old growth forests and then put the trees down in old salt mines to sequester the carbon. And I mean, even sort of the mainstream press laughed at that because it was so stupid. But now if you turn it into charcoal and bury it, then suddenly it's a good idea. It just, I guess what I'm trying to get at is this also this notion of, it seems to me that biomass and biofuel and bioenergy and all that stuff is pretty much the apotheosis of this whole culture that is simply trying to turn the entire world into fuel for a machine. I mean, that's you can't get really a better example than cutting down a living forest and putting it in your car or putting it into – yeah, you can. A better example is using it, turning it into jet fuel and using it for a drone. You know, like that's the best possible example you could get of this entire culture's movement, it seems to me.
Yeah, it's, I agree with your assessment. I think I spent some time just today, for example, looking at, the Department of Energy's, program on genomics, the DOE USDA genomics program. And, the language that they use really is, we are interested in finding new ways to understand biology and natural systems in order to use them to make fuel. And that's kind of, that's their entire sort of vision, that everything out there. So people talk about extreme energy extraction, and they're usually thinking about fossil fuels and drilling for oil and so on and so forth. But another version of extreme extraction is going on, which is the hijacking of the genetic history and coding of life on Earth, as long with, all of the quote unquote biomass. And, I should say too that one of the side effects of this huge push has been increasing interest on the part of investors to get hold of and own and get access to arable lands in various places. So, there's been a huge wave of land grabs going on around the globe. In places like Africa in particular, more than half of those land grabs, of course, some of them are countries that are looking to buy arable land to feed their population because, they have, you know, they're groaning, under the weight of needing to feed so many people and their diets are changing more towards meat, et cetera. But more than half of the land grabs in Africa were from by investors who were looking to, cultivate bioenergy crops of various sorts. So it's had this, you know, impact of, you know, land grabs.
And one of the things that this is saying explicitly, and this is also making very clear, is that, and I was thinking about this when you said that what was the percentage of corn that is used in the United States for ethanol or biofuels at this point?
It's about 40%.
Okay, so at this point, and this has been true for a long time, but this just makes really clear, and also the land grabs where people want food, want land for food, is that the technologies and the machines are actually in competition with us for fuel. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? They're actually they're taking things that we could eat and using them as fuel for the machines instead, and that it's just, it's very weird. And this is, once again, this whole culture, but the machines are actually taking our food.
Yes. Well, I think the most clear, way of viewing that is that, you know, private car ownership is a phenomenon of wealthy, you know, northern hemisphere countries. Whereas the impacts of this push to, you know, provide, to turn food into fuel is felt by people all over the world who don't drive cars at all. So, the burning of food for driving cars and machinery as well, and all manner of other, as I said, it's much bigger than just personal car, you know, use, but it's been framed in those terms, and many people understand it in those terms.
So I think there's three directions I'm thinking of going, and you can go in any order you want. One is, can you talk about the effects of these biofuels on so-called biofuels on indigenous humans? And can you talk about the relationship and the effects, some of the tangible effects on biodiversity? And also, can you talk about the relationship you mentioned, the relationship between genetic engineering and biofuels? So can you hit those three topics in whatever order and at whatever length you'd like?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of the work that we've done in collaboration with indigenous peoples has been around the overall push to for market-based approaches to the issues around climate change. So reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, the RED initiative under the UN climate negotiations, which has been very troublesome for a lot of forest-dependent indigenous peoples, because they see it as a new wave of commodification of forests, where the carbon in the forest now belongs to some polluter somewhere far away, and, you know, disenfranchises their own control over their own lands. And the links with bioenergy there are that under definitions of forest as we have them now, under the UN in particular, the definition of a forest includes, you know, things like palm oil plantations, which are often used for biodiesel. So tree plantations are referred to in many cases as forests under the definition. And RED can allow a plantation of palm oil to be used as an offset by some polluter somewhere. And then the palm oil is used for biodiesel, or even burned directly for heating and electricity in some places, for example, in Europe. So there's a definite link between that. I think another, in addition to indigenous peoples and the impacts that they feel are the impacts on peasant farmers. In Latin America, the expansion of soy, which has been incredibly destructive to people, both because, first, it's been destructive to forested lands, and it's degraded the soils, and it's caused a lot of people to be pushed off their lands, so that they're unable to feed their families anymore. And they've, you know, had to move into the margins of cities and live in slums and so on. So a lot of that has had to do with the expansion of soy in Latin America. It's also very, very much dependent on GMO soy, which is sprayed intensively with chemicals, and the impacts on people who are living in the surrounding areas. You know, people are literally killed by being sprayed with glyphosate and other herbicides and chemicals that are used in growing industrial soy, which is one of the main feedstocks being used for biodiesel. So it's peasant farmers also, as well as indigenous peoples who are impacted. Now, you asked me also to talk some about the biotechnology angle. And I mentioned earlier that, you know, that there's a big push now to engineer various different crops and also microbes. And those are probably the two main focus, but also trees. I'm now been working with allies at the Campaign to Stop GE Trees here in the United States and internationally. And the companies like Arborgen and other tree biotechnology companies are working very hard to develop trees that will grow very quickly. Their vision is that they will plant these in huge big plantations, which may be referred to as forests, even though they will be one species of tree, all one age. They will grow those, and they're very much looking at the growing demand for bioenergy as one of the reasons why they foresee a captive market for their genetically engineered trees in the future. So, you know, we've been trying really hard to push back on this issue through the Convention on Biodiversity and various other venues. Right now in the United States, there are somewhere around 250,000 genetically engineered eucalyptus that are being field tested across the southern United States. And the company Arborgen is seeking to develop a eucalypt that will be cold tolerant so that they can expand the range of these eucalyptus.
Great idea. Let's have an invasive species that also toxifies the soil and then genetically engineer it so that it can increase its range. Isn't that a great idea?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there are already vast plantations of eucalyptus in various parts of the world.
Oh, and that burns. And that burns hot.
It burns and burns hot, and also it's one of the most thirsty of trees. It puts a deep root down and really requires a lot of water. So it's where it's grown in plantations, it has severe impacts on the water supplies already.
What could possibly go wrong?
I don't know. I can't imagine. So anyway, I invite people to pay attention to this because we're any day expecting a draft environmental impact statement on this eucalypt. This eucalyptus, which the company has filed for deregulation of this tree, and the Center for Food Safety and Global Justice Ecology Project, the World Rainforest Movement, Indigenous Environmental Network, various other groups have been trying to raise alarms about this to get people motivated and engaged to push back against this before we find the first genetically engineered trees planted here in the U.S. And there's a similar push in Brazil right now to try and get them deregulated there as well.
The third thing I wanted to ask you about there was the effects of all of these so-called biofuels, etc., on biodiversity. Can you talk more explicitly about that?
Yeah, well, of course, anything that you know, basically takes a biodiverse landscape, they say the Cerrado in Latin America, and turns it into a sugarcane plantation, is going to basically, you know, displace all of the biodiversity that was on that land. So this is, you know, the expanding demand for crops and agriculture and wood has huge impacts on biodiversity. In the United States, the Conservation Reserve Program was one of the most successful biodiversity protection programs that had basically been paying or has been paying farmers to set aside parts of their land that are especially important along the barriers and buffers around streams and to provide niches for biodiversity within the otherwise vast areas of corn monocultures and soy monocultures, et cetera. But with the price of corn, you know, that's the problem is now the price of corn, which is linked to the price of energy, has gone up to the point where many farmers are now plowing under their conservation reserve program lands in favor of expanding the amount of corn that they're growing. The other point here is that there's a lot of knock-on effects, so they're indirect. The classic case is that as the price of corn in the U.S. went up with the demand for ethanol, soy production in the U.S. dropped because farmers found it more lucrative to grow corn. So the soy production dropped, and there was sort of a vacuum in the soy market, which is a big part of that is for animal feed. So Brazil picked up the slack in the soy market by a series of steps that resulted in further deforestation in the Amazon. So the thing, of course, is that all of these things are linked. We live in this globalized economy on a planet that has very limited resources, and we have these, you know, internationally traded commodity crops like corn and soy and wood that are that have a domino effect all around the globe when we introduce huge new demands.
I want to mention two creatures I've heard about specifically who've been harmed by the whole explosion of biofuels, and then perhaps you can name a few others. One is I've heard that that's one of the reasons for the current collapse of monarch butterflies through. Exactly what you're talking about with the increase in corn production has taken out more areas where milkweed grew. And another is orangutans. People, I think, have heard about those being killed for the palm oil plantations. And can you name a few other species specifically that either people might have heard of or that they have not heard of that are especially dear to you, that just so you can at least acknowledge them?
Well,
I think that's really important too.
Yeah,
no, you know, it's kind of like the AIDS quilt or, you know, the Vietnam Memorial Wall.
Right. And I'm a little, people don't usually ask me that question, so I'm a little bit like, oh, this is interesting. How shall I do this? But I really want to touch back on the orangutans if I can. But I first also want to just raise a shout out for the microbial life in soils, because we don't see that. It's not cute and cuddly, but it is really the basis of life for us on this planet, because it's what supports plant growth and allows us to have oxygen and allows us to live. So that would be my shout out for biodiversity. And of course, all of the abuse of soils that we do, we basically treat them as a substrate rather than as a living organism. We, till, we dump chemicals, we cut, we harvest, we drive over it and, you know, cut it and harvest it and spray it again. It's just a substrate. Dump fertilizer in there because the soil is so depleted. So anyway, that's where I would give my call out, just for the heck of it. But I wanted to go back to the orangutans because there's a little personal story for me here, which is that you mentioned when you introduced me that I had written a book about dolphins, which is true. And I came to this work actually as a zoologist. I'd spent 15 or 20 years doing field biology on this dolphin project, and in the process I had also worked on a lot of projects looking at various different species of primates. And one of the things that I did was I spent some time in Borneo at some of the orangutan rehabilitation centers, and I did that, you know, I was fresh out of college and I saw a National Geographic film about deforestation in Borneo. And there was an orangutan in that film that was stranded in a tree, and the last of the trees was being cut down all around it. And the orangutan, there was a guy with a chainsaw standing at the base of the tree that the orangutan was in, and it climbed down out of the tree and took hold of this man by the shoulders and stared into its face. And you could see it just saying, "What the hell are you doing? You know, who are you? Just take a look at yourself." And then it ran off into the wasteland that was surrounding it. And I was so amazed by this animal and its very clear, you know, consciousness, and that's what mobilized me to actually go to Borneo in the first place, and circumstances allowed it. But it was years later, after I had done various other things in my life and had kids and been a mom for a while, et cetera, I was casting about for something to do, and I heard a little bit about the impacts of palm oil in Indonesia and Malaysia and started researching it. And that was just as palm oil was starting to be expanded dramatically for biofuels. And that's how I came to working on this whole issue.
Yeah, that's really moving. Right now I'm just finishing a book about, human supremacism and what's wrong with it, and how it's just so ridiculous on every level. And what I'm specifically writing about right now is how we think we're so, one of the tests of consciousness is the mirror test, where you show a creature a mirror, and then if it responds and knows that it has a smudge on its face or something, if it knows that that's its image in the mirror, that it is, that means it's conscious. And I'm saying all sorts of things about how that's really ridiculous on a bunch of other levels. And then I say, are you kidding? Members of this culture saying that when somebody else looks in the mirror, they don't see themselves? You know, I mean, look at this on a larger scale of, I mean, that orangutan looked in the man's face, and the orangutan saw the man better than the man with the chainsaw saw himself, you know? It's like we look in a mirror and we see God's gift to the universe, and everybody else looks at us and it's like, oh my God, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, well, people often ask me, you know, what did you really learn from your experience as a zoologist? And my pat answer is, I learned that people vastly underestimate other living beings.
Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe if you wanted, we could do a whole conversation sometime about the intelligence of bacteria. I just think that's incredibly fascinating. They're really smart. And anyway, that's back to biofuels. You know, I hear everything you're saying. I want to let you know, this is there. You have a sarcasm/irony alert before this starts. but we, you know, I hear what you're saying. Things are bad, but I saw this article the other day that actually, genetically engineered algae is going to save us because it is so cool, and you can make these little ponds that will produce all this energy. Isn't it a fabulous, fabulous thing?
Well, I'm glad you're being sarcastic about it, because that saves me a little bit of space. But yeah, the algae.
I mean, you've seen those articles, right?
Yeah, sure. You go on the websites and it says all we need is, you know, sunshine, water, and CO2, which of course we have too much of, and we can make, you know, anything and make energy out of that. What's missing from that equation, of course, is that algae needs a lot of different kinds of nutrients, just as any living thing does. And one of the things that's very troubling to me, I mean, the algae biofuels thing has been underway for, you know, decades. They've been trying to make it at commercial scale, and they can make, you know, small scale bits of algae biofuels, but they haven't been able to scale it up for various different reasons. But one of the things that really troubles me about the push with algae, first of all, is that it's very much dependent on biotechnology, and on there's a big focus of the synthetic biology biotechnology push that I mentioned earlier. There are a lot of companies that are looking to, you know, really manipulate and tweak various species of algae to pump out drop-in hydrocarbon fuels, you know, basically get an algae to spit out a fuel you can put directly into a jet. and that takes a lot of, you know, alteration to the whole metabolic system of an algae. And these are, you know, mostly microalgae, almost entirely microalgae that they're focused on, which, you know, have a tendency to secrete a lot of oils. That's why they're so interesting. But they're also, we know very little about microalgae biology. We know very well, however, that we've seen how invasive they can be. We've seen the consequences of algae blooms where they're not supposed to be. So here they are taking all these species, they're engineering them, and they're engineering them specifically for the traits that are associated with invasiveness. They want things that are very hardy, that, you know, grow really fast, that can put up with inconvenient, you know, water temperatures and chemistries and other invading microbes and diseases and stuff. They want something super, super hardy, which is exactly what invasiveness, the characteristics of invasiveness. And they're, you know, wanting to cultivate these en masse in various different places. It's very energy intensive to cultivate them in. Also because you have to have, you know, circulating water, and the water that requires electricity. You have to dry out the algae and separate the oil, et cetera, once you've done your cultivation. So the energy demands, which are, you know, not included in that sunshine, water, and CO2, it's all very beautiful. There's a lot of missing pieces, and there's a lot of concern about the biotechnology push with algae in my mind, and the invasiveness of different algae species.
So this is a question I haven't asked any of the activists or writers or anybody whom I've interviewed yet, but it's something that my friends and I ask each other and talk about all the time. Are you scared? And I don't mean by this of government repression. That's a topic we can or can't talk about. It doesn't matter to me. But are you scared for the future? I mean, I'm terrified every single day.
Well, you know, personally, I'm not myself scared for myself because,
I didn't mean for you or me.
Yeah. I have two kids and I'm terrified for their future. Yeah. I think if you spend enough time looking at the science of climate and at the unbelievable blundering around that's been the human response to understanding that, it's hard, very hard to be hopeful at this point. So we'll see.
What do you, here's a question I've asked a couple people, and I think it's kind of an interesting question. What do you, if they could make you, czar of biofuel czar, or I don't know if that's the right term, biofuel, but if they could make you in charge, if you could set some policy for some particular issues associated that you work on, what would you actually, and the caveat here is I'm going to make it so you can't say, okay, I would get rid of industrial civilization. It never existed. You know, you can't quite do that. That's the longer term question. But if they could just do some sort of, if you were made in charge of biofuels policy, what would you do? What do you want to have happen on a large scale, considering the fact that we do have, you can't even get rid of capitalism. Let's say you can't get rid of capitalism today. You can get rid of it in 3 weeks. But the first 3 weeks, you know, you have to, what sort of policies would you actually want to see in place?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most immediate would be to get rid of the targets and mandates for biofuels that are written into various legislation and the subsidies that are put into it, because it's an entirely artificial market. And without that, it would collapse. So that would be my first push. Now, a lot of environmental groups in particular, as well as the industry, would like to talk about sustainability standards being the answer. You know, if we just say that we won't take any biomass from, you know, areas of high biodiversity, and we'll make sure that, you know, this, that, and the other, and have some various standards, they think that that's going to resolve the problem. But, of course, the thing is that this is a battle between money and mandates and some nice words on paper about what should be done. Whereas with sustainability standards, there's no independent assessment of whether on the ground the terms have actually been met. You can look at the Forest Stewardship Council as one example. You know, it's had some positive impact in some places, but many of these sustainability standards are just fraught with problems. So, there's no way that sustainability standards is going to provide an answer and resolve the problems. What would really help is to stop bolstering this artificial market. And I think a deeper issue is education. You know, people, well-meaning, well-intended people, just don't really grasp the severity of the situation, and they don't understand biology and the natural world, so they can't understand that, for example, fueling all of the cars in the United States with corn ethanol takes a heck of a lot of corn. You know, they just don't make that connection to the scale of impacts that has. So I think those are the two things.
You mentioned in sustainability standards, you mentioned something about not going into areas that are especially biodiverse. And I have a problem with that language as well, in that one is I don't think any place should be a sacrifice zone. And the other is, and I'm not disagreeing with you, I'm disagreeing with the whole notion. And the other is that when I think of places like Iowa, I don't think of particular biodiversity. But I recently came across a book maybe a year ago called A Country So Rich in Game, that was early European accounts of Iowa. And it was one of the most incredibly biodiverse places on the continent. And it, if it were returned to prairie, much of that biodiversity would return. And so even places that are already considered sacrifice zones, you know, much all those cornfields, if they were allowed to be what they want to be and be who they want to be, there is much that could go right in that too. So when they talk about places, yes, of course, protect places that are especially biodiverse, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't protect the Mojave Desert, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't protect, you know, parts of Iowa or Illinois. I know you weren't saying that. It's just that's, you brought up one of those sort of pet peeves I've got.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I'm totally in agreement with you on that point, and that's one of the reasons I sort of said that with a tone of sarcasm, because that let's just protect a little bit of this where we think that we happen to think is biodiverse and let the rest be a sacrifice zone is certainly not a viable path to a livable future, let's just say.
So we have like a couple minutes left, and I guess I have two wrap-up questions. One of them is, so if you could have listeners to this interview, you know, a week from now, they're going to be saying, so I heard this great interview last week, and it was about what? I mean, what is sort of your one-sentence summation? It's like in the 1970s, I saw Star Wars, and the only thing I really remember is use the Force. So, you know, if you have one thing, what's the one message you really want people to get in their hearts from what you've said?
I guess I would say something along the lines of let's focus on protecting and restoring and changing our relationship to nature rather than looking at it as a source of fuel and materials.
That's great. And then the last question is, one of the things I really am, the reason I'm doing these interviews is because I want to help people to get off their behinds and actually do something. Because there is so much could be accomplished if simply more people would just do something. Oh, and we have enough time. I want to tell you a real quick story. And I've told this story before, but the way I actually got into activism in the first place was through fuel. Because I realized I wasn't paying enough. This is my mid-20s. I wasn't paying enough for gas to cover the social and ecological costs. And meanwhile, the problems, I recognize this whole culture is killing the planet. It's too big. I can't do anything. I was intimidated. What am I going to do? So I didn't do anything, of course. And then since I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas, I thought for every dollar I spend on gasoline, I will give a dollar to a local environmental organization to try to offset. But I didn't have any money. And so what I started doing is I paid myself $5 an hour to do activism. That's actually how I got my whole start, was I got off my butt to – and it was doable. You know, if I spend $10 on gas, that's just 2 hours of work. And anybody can do 2 hours of work, except maybe, you know, a single mother with five children or something. You know, almost anybody can take away – you know, don't watch one football game or something. Or even watch a football game, and while you're watching the football game, write a letter to the editor. That's how I got started. And so my question is, people who are listening to this interview, what do you actually want them to do regarding this particular issue? What can they do that would be helpful?
Well, first of all, don't drink the Kool-Aid about biofuels. It's, you know, it's really been a very destructive and is not a solution. We need to be focusing on other things, as I said, protecting and restoring nature and learning how to live with a whole lot less energy, which I know is a very unpopular idea for many people, and especially for those who would like to see capitalism, you know, stay in place as it is. But the other thing I think is that I would ask people to really dig deep into the issues that they're going to be active on, because one of the problems in working in, you know, we work as part of networks on climate justice issues, and that bioenergy is our particular specialty within that broader network of work that we do. And what's been very difficult is that there are a lot of false solutions, biofuels being one of them, but many others as well, like carbon markets and so on, offsetting, et cetera, false solutions to the problem that have caused a huge distraction away from the measures that really would work, that we know could work, and from taking the steps that we desperately need to take in order to get where we need to go. So I am encourage people to get active, but I also encourage them to be very careful in what kinds of things they call for. So, you know, the New York City big climate march that just happened, I and some other people were fairly critical of it because there were no specific demands. And the march was very reflective of that. There were people with biofuel banners marching next to other people who were, you know, from Environmental Defense Fund. My father is a founder of that organization, by the way, and I have big issues with them. But the point is just being very careful what it is you're asking for. Going out there and saying, oh, we want action on climate. You recognize the fact that there are a lot of companies and startups and interests out there that are offering false solutions, and they can't wait for you to go out there and make vague demands that will allow them to put their false solutions onto the table more firmly. So people need to be very, very thoughtful in their activism.
You know, that's, and thank you for saying that. I think that's incredibly important. And it reminds me of a problem that there's a concern I've had about a lot of the climate movement for a long time, that there's been something I don't understand, which is a long time ago, the guy who got me started in environmentalism, would always say that a lot of grassroots environmental activists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of the entire culture. And I've so often wondered how so many climate activists don't end up digging quite as deep as a lot of grassroots environmental activists that I've known forever. And I was really curious about that for the longest time until I suddenly realized that a lot of climate activists are not they're climate activists, and they aren't actually environmentalists. And that's a distinction that I think is really crucial. And that doesn't mean they're bad. It just means that, like, if somebody is suggesting, yay, biofuels is the answer, they're trying to answer that one specific question, rightly or wrongly, but they still don't have the same goals in mind that I do, and I perceive you do, which the ultimate goal is biodiversity and a healthy planet. And I don't know. You don't have to respond to that at all. It's just something I've been thinking about a lot.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, you touched on another issue that I think is really important, which is people get very focused on one issue that they're working on. And it may be something that's happening in their local piece of turf, or it may be, you know, the fracking issue, or it may be biofuels, or it may be, you know, nuclear anti-nuke movement, or, you know, forest protection. Everybody is working on their own little issues, and often, in such seclusion that they don't understand, the connections that are there that could be made to make a more powerful movement. B, that sometimes when they're calling for what they want, they're only making the problem worse for others. So, for example, all the definitions of renewable energy that are out there do not distinguish between bioenergy and biofuels or other things that require burning and pollute the air and cause people to have asthma, et cetera. They don't distinguish between those and, say, windmills and solar panels. So when people call for an end to fracking or no more nukes and let's have 100% renewable energy, you know, I often find myself breathing a deep sigh of dismay, because I know that a vast portion of the supports and subsidies and so on that go to quote unquote renewable energy are going to biofuels. So that's just one example where, you know, we end up working at odds because we have such a narrow focus on the one battle that we are focused on, that we're really passionate about, without kind of connecting with other people and other issues to the extent that is necessary.
Well, I think for me, and thank you for saying that, I think for me, the underlying thing at all points is the health of the planet. You know, it's like, does it actually help is the planet healthier? Is the planet a better place because of this action? And that is, for me, is always the question.
Yeah, I agree. But I think many people would answer, you know, say, for example, calling for 100% renewable energy will make the planet a better place. Many people would say yes to that. But if you dig deeper into that, and again, that goes back to my previous plea to people to be thoughtful, you know, think about what does it take to build solar panels and windmills on the scale that would be needed to simply replace all of our energy demands with renewable energy.
Yep.
So, and what do we use that energy for, and who uses it, and who owns it, and whose distribution is it, who's buying and selling it? So all of those other questions sort of fall by the wayside when we just, you know, shout out, oh, we want 100% renewable energy. Everything will be just the same, but we'll have, you know, solar panels and bioenergy instead of fossil fuels, as if that's possible.
Yes. And we're out of time, and well, which is true on a larger scale too. But anyway, thank you so much. Excuse me. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for listening. My guest today has been Rachel Smolker. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.